What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Date Night Podcast. We are so excited for this new season of Date Night that starts right now. And to kick it off, we have invited someone that has become a friend of mine, international author and speaker Gary Thomas. This man has written so many books. He's had an incredible journey, over 20 something books, speaks all over the world. But let me tell you something, of all of those things, the most important thing to me is that this guy has not only written two books that have radically changed my life, Sacred Pathways and The Sacred Search, but he has also become someone that's linked arms with me and helped me navigate marriage, navigate ministry, navigate how to lead people. And it's been really just such a blessing for me. And so I am thrilled that he's been willing to come and to share with you guys and share with me. And I believe this is going to be a message that will radically impact your marriage. So help me. Join me in welcoming author and speaker Gary Thomas to come and share with us to kick off this brand new season of Date Night.
Well, about 9 years ago, my wife and I got our first trip to Europe. A publisher in Germany was bringing out three of my books in German, and they wanted me to do a book tour. We had kids that were younger, and we didn't have the money or the time, so we had never been to Europe. So before we went out there, Lisa said, why don't we go out a week earlier before the tour? We can just sort of play on our own and have a good time, and then they'll pick you up for the book tour. I thought, that sounded great. I already had a lot of engagement, so we're kind of shoehorning this international trip in, and I kind of get focused on the task at hand. So Lisa would ask me the details. What kind of car do you want me to rent? Where do you think you'd want to visit? And I would just kind of, you know, give a perfunctory answer. And so when she came up to the car, I said, well, just get a midsize. So we land in Frankfurt, and I get into Germany. I really hadn't started thinking about Germany until we land. And when we got to the place where you pick up your rental car, I realized that a midsize car in Germany is not a midsize car in the United States. And to my horror, we had ridden a Fiat Punto, right? Now, they don't sell Fiat Puntos in the United States because the SUVs would run over them and not even know it. And then it finally dawned on me, if you think of bucket list items, right, in your lifetime, a lot of guys, even some of the women, this, what do you think of a bucket list item as being in Germany? The Autobahn. See, you guys get it, right? I was just so dense. I didn't even think about it. And so I finally get onto the Autobahn in a Fiat Punto. And I could feel the testosterone draining out of my body as I'm on the BMWs and the Mercedes-Benz and even the Volvos are just past me. After about an hour or two of it, it was so frustrating. I finally got to pass somebody. It was a vegetable truck. It was loaded down with corn, and I needed to pass something on the Autobahn. And so I had to look in the rearview mirror because, I mean, they could be going 200 miles an hour, right? I had to have a running start. Finally got over. I passed it, and I just couldn't believe how stupid I was. I got this chance to drive on the Autobahn, and I'm in a Fiat Punto. So we suffered through that for about a week. Publisher picked us up, and then we did the week thing, and then they dropped us off at the end. I did a conference up at the North Sea, and it's a beautiful place, and then I was done. They were going to have us take a train back to Frankfurt so we could fly back to Houston. Well, I'd gone on the internet and figured out that for the same price as two tickets from the up on the North Sea down to Frankfurt, I could rent one way a Mercedes-Benz manual transmission for the same price. I talked to our host. He said, it doesn't make any difference to us. For the same price, sure, if you want to drive, you can do that. And Lisa was agreeable, which was very kind of her. And so on our way back, I finally got to drive on the Autobahn in a car worthy of the Autobahn, a car designed for the Autobahn. It was two entirely different experiences. I mean, if I'd never gotten to done that, I never really felt like I'd driven on the Autobahn. In the same way in marriage, you might be married and another couple might be married, and you feel like you and your spouse are in this Fiat Punto, right? I mean, you're sort of puttering along, and then here come the BMWs and the Mercedes-Benz, and maybe they've been married half as long as you are, and you thought, how do I get from the Fiat Punto into the Mercedes-Benz or the BMW where I could really experience what it's all about? It won't happen by accident. The reason marriage can be difficult, the reason that marriage can be good, you could feel like you're driving a Mercedes-Benz and then wake up and feel like you're driving a Fiat Punto. The reason you can happen is the biblical reality of sin, the fall. And because of the fall, drift is always downward. Ever thought of that? Whenever you drift, you always drift downward. D.A. Carson wrote this. One of the most striking evidences of sinful human nature lies in the universal propensity for downward drift. You don't drift into physical fitness, you drift into becoming a couch potato. You don't drift into becoming wise, you drift into watching mindless television. And you don't drift into an intimate marriage, you drift into becoming strangers. If it's not an intentional pursuit to keep growing together, because, you know, you could be in great shape one time and then you drift and you're not in good shape even though once you were. Same thing can happen in marriage. If it's not a continual, intentional pursuit, it shouldn't be a surprise if you feel distance in your relationship. Before you reject the spouse because your relationship has become distant, I want you to reject the drift. And I want to give four spiritual keys, really, where the Bible helps us. These are ways that we follow through on our vows. I've never had the guts to do this, really, but when you ask couples this and they say, I do, I kind of want to have them add, and I will. It's one thing to make a promise on the day you get married. I do. I agree with this. But the question is, will you continue to do that? And these are the four attitudes. There's four things that Jesus calls us to do and be that if we keep doing them, our marriages will continue to grow in intimacy. So let's just get right into these four. We don't have a lot of time. The first thing is honesty. First thing is honesty for saying, I will. Guys, this is what most of us fear most. By guys, I mean men. For whatever reason, we are terrified of letting our wives in. Some of you wives may not realize, but some of us, we're just astonished we got one of you to marry us. You know, maybe we were the ones that were cut from the team or fired from the job or rejected from the college or whatnot. And we feel like if you really got to know us, you'd be so appalled at the choice you made that you wouldn't stand a chance of staying with us. Now, some guys, you think you're the gift to everybody, so that you're different. But for a lot of us with that insecurity, that's a problem. And here's the thing I'll tell you guys in those marriages. When I talk to these wives, they're more terrified of what they don't know than what you would tell them. What they think it might be seems far worse to them. They would rather deal with what is, and they know when we're not letting them in. And you can't rebuild your marriage without a commitment to a new kind of honesty. I was working with a young couple, and the wife, committed believer, knew something wasn't right. And she talked to her husband and she said, look, I'm the kind of woman who will work through anything. She goes, and I mean anything to keep this marriage together. I just need to know what we're dealing with. She opened wide the door. Let's be honest. Let's be intimate. Let's be real with each other. And he shared probably the 10th most significant sin that was going on in his life back then. She opened up the door. He jettisoned. He refused it. So when inevitably the truth comes out months later, the marriage is over. She certainly had biblical reasons, but she realized, I can't rebuild a marriage with someone who won't be honest with me. That's what happened when dishonesty wrecked a marriage. When honesty helped rebuild a marriage, it was with a guy named Justin Davis and his wife, Tricia. He seemed like a great catch to her when they got married. He was a pastor. He was a zealous Christian. He seemed to be really relationally involved. What she didn't know was that he'd had a lifelong battle with pornography. And he had kept it from her. And he'd been hiding it from her. And here's the problem with deception. It grows. It becomes a part of us. And eventually pornography alone isn't enough. So he decides to have an affair with her best friend. Yeah, imagine Tricia in one horrendous night to realize she has lost her husband, her pastor, and her best friend. It took weeks and months. I don't have time to get into the whole story about how the marriage was put together, but she was willing to forgive Justin was willing to be honest and do the work. And as they look back, they would say what really saved their marriage was a new commitment to honesty, because Justin realized it was his commitment to deception that kept them from growing their marriage in the first place. So he has these four questions that he keeps asking himself so they can keep pursuing honesty. The first one is this: is the fear of consequences of the truth greater than my commitment to tell the truth? We don't want to be honest because we're afraid of the consequences, but that keeps us in the dark. It keeps us in dishonesty. Am I telling myself the truth? Deception becomes a character issue. We lie to our spouse. We end up lying to ourselves. Is there a truth I have distorted or am distorting right now? And is there something I have withheld or am currently withholding from my spouse? I'll say this. We can only be as intimate with each other as we are honest. And it's not just about each other. It's about God bringing God more into the relationship. I realized one time, I really can't imagine anything that my wife isn't okay with that God is. Maybe. I don't know that God minds if I occasionally have a chocolate chip cookie or a bag of Doritos. It may not be the big compromise to him that it is to mine. But for serious substantive issues, really, if my wife would have a problem with it, God would have a problem with it. And so when I am hiding from my wife, ultimately I am hiding from my God. What you are hiding from your spouse, in some sense, you are probably also hiding from your God. And we can't be close to God if we're not honest with God. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. To push out honesty is to push out God. And I'll just tell you this, lying destroys personal peace. If I am lying to my spouse, I'm afraid of my spouse. I'm dreading the day my spouse finds something else. There can be no peace in a marriage where there's deception. There can be no intimacy, because if I let her in, if you let him in, then they might discern what else is going on. And the fear of that keeps you from letting them in at all. If you want to have an intimate marriage, you have to be committed to honesty. Now, let me just say as a very quick caveat, if this is a big thing, you need to talk to a counselor or a pastor and not have a conversation tonight, okay? Seriously, I mean that. Some issues, you're moving toward honesty, but some issues, for instance, if you go through recovery groups for men and pornography and whatnot, they will usually recommend a guy get 6 months of sobriety before he shares it, because there can be PTSD for a wife that finds that out, and they don't want the wife to have to go through that cycle. So don't take this without discernment. This is ultimately a commitment. This is the direction we want to head. If we want to have one of those marriages in the Mercedes-Benz on the Autobahn, eventually we have to get to a place of complete honesty. The second thing that we have to do for I do and will is this. It's a blessing mentality. There are two dimensions of blessing. It goes to the whole root of how God deals with people. Remember what God said to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, he says, I will bless you so that you will be a blessing. The essence of life with God is to receive blessing from God so we pass it out to others. Where marriages run into the rocks is that we go to our spouse to receive the blessing and not from God. So our focus isn't on passing on the blessing. Our focus is, why isn't my spouse giving me that blessing? But really, every day I wake up with my wife, I can have one of two attitudes. How can I bless you? Or how can I get my needs met? Now, if I'm not spiritually, intentionally pursuing an intimate marriage, I drift into, how can I get my needs met? How can I convince my wife to do this? How do I convince my spouse not to do that? How can I get them to meet that? Because if I'm not receiving from God, I don't have that propulsion to, that compulsion to give and to bless others. Krista experienced this with her husband, Caleb, who was a brigade surgeon in Iraq. During a time in the Iraq war when men were dying by the day, it was an awful job, as you can imagine. The deaths he faced, the cleanup that he had to do. And he'd been stationed in Iraq for 6 months, and he found out he'd had a two-week leave. He sent an email to his wife, Krista, said, "Hey, I've got a two-week leave coming up." And Krista opened up the email, and she said, "Yes. I've been a single mom for 6 months. They had two kids." She was so ready for Caleb to take over. Said, "I'm going to get the nails done. I'm going to get the hair done. I'm going to finally get lunch with Becca." She couldn't wait. But she paused before Caleb came home, and she asked herself, "What if my greatest need isn't to be loved? What if my greatest need is to learn how to love?" And here's how she put it in the prayer. "How can I fill up my husband, spirit, soul, and body so that he can go back to war for 6 more months?" Having been virtually a single mom for 6 months, it's a natural question to say, what do I need to get done? But she just wanted to take this blessing mentality. Look, he's been at war for 6 months. He's been serving our country and protecting our family. What does he need? And when she sat before the Lord, she was amazed at the answers that God gave to her. So she wrote to Caleb. She said, "Look, I know you haven't been eating the best. What would you like to eat when you get back?" He mentioned some things. She went to a grocery store, bought everything on the list. And she went to an entirely different store. And in her words, she bought 7 bedroom outfits in 7 different colors. Then she went to a bookstore and she bought a book on massage. In her words, she studied it. She memorized it. And then she arranged 24-hour childcare for when her husband first got home. She figured he's been a soldier away from his wife. He's going to want to enjoy her. There are things the kids shouldn't hear or see. Let's just get them miles and miles away. So Caleb came in, and in her words, she says, there's just something about guys, when they return from war, that the stench of war just stays with them. So she brought these fresh civilian clothes. They went out to dinner and the kids had a good time, but then she had a really fun place for the kids to go. They finally arrive home, and Kristen knows that Caleb's love language is physical touch, so she ran a bath, and I'll let her pick up the story from here. She said this, "I straddled the tub with my big sponge and began to cleanse the smells of war. And as I washed the odor of war away, I prayed to cleanse his soul from the spirit of death and destruction. As I washed his head and hair, I prayed, 'Lord, let nothing he has thought harm him.' As I wiped his eyes, I prayed, 'Lord, let nothing he has seen stay in his heart.' As I washed his ears, I prayed, 'Lord, let nothing he has heard touch his spirit.' I washed and prayed over every part of my husband, begging God that nothing would take root, that all evil would be washed away." So I read this account, I thought, what a spiritual moment. This woman is welcoming her husband home from war. He's been sacrificing himself. She's literally anointing spiritually every part of his body. "Lord, to help protect us, he's seen terrible things. Heal his eyes. He's heard awful things. Heal his ears." I mean, it's just such a spiritual moment in a marriage. And then it becomes very physical. She gets in the tub with him, cleans up a little bit. She says, "All right, honey, pick a color." He said, "What?" She goes, "Pick a color." He's like, "Why?" She goes, "Just pick a color. You'll be glad you did." Blue. She got out of the tub, came back in a blue bedroom outfit, and in her words, "We made love in the 5 times in the first 24 hours he was home. Was this even physically possible?" I don't know, that might take Marine training, but that's Caleb's story, not ours. A couple days later, Krista put the massage techniques into practice. It's in the middle of the afternoon. Caleb fell asleep for 2 hours. He wakes up and he's just groggy and he says, "Honey, that was amazing. I didn't sleep like that the entire time I was in Iraq." Now, Caleb also stepped up. She got to get her nails done. She got her hair done. She got to have that lunch with Becca. But the 2 weeks went by before she could believe it. And they were rich weeks for her. Here's how she described them. "Our 2 weeks were a supernatural feast of intimacy with the Lord and with one another." How many of you wives would love to be able to describe 14 days with your husband as a supernatural feast of intimacy? Something beyond this world, not just a little bit, a feast, intimacy of the best kind, God and your husband joined. How did she get there? Because she kept living with that blessing mentality. Here's what she said. Had I loved him, spirit, soul, and body, so he was ready to go back to war. 3 days after he got back, he emailed me and said, thank you for the best 2 weeks of my life. So it was the same for him. And again, I don't want to lose the wives here because I know in the natural you'd say, that's not fair. I've been a single mom. I know. It makes all the natural sense to me in the world. But do we want a supernatural marriage? So guys, if you're the one that works and you're coming home from work instead of saying, man, I just need this from a wife. When a guy travels or when a guy works, I say, no, what does your wife need? It is a mindset. Lord, how do I receive from you in the morning and on the way home and during lunch so that with my attitude with my spouse, it's not how can I get my needs met, but I'm blessed to bless her. I'm blessed to bless him. I honestly believe this, that most divorces today could be wiped out if we would live with this commitment. How could I bless my spouse today? If we honestly woke up and said, how do I practically bless my spouse today? It would revolutionize every marriage in this church. Third, killing spiders. We have to have the attitude of this little boy. We could go to the next slide, please. I don't care how small that spider is, I want it dead. Here's what I mean by killing spiders. I don't have a problem with spiders. They never freak me out, but Lisa hates them, especially if they're inside the house. She's not expecting to see them, and she sees a spider, I kill it because it bothers her. Being married to Lisa makes me want to kill something that bothers her. I don't have the issue. She's got the issue, but my commitment to being married to her and her welfare means that spider has to die. How does this apply in marriage? All right. Let's say Lisa's dad was an alcoholic. He definitely was not. He was a great man. I'm just using an analogy here. I think the great way to kill that spider right there would say, look, I'm marrying a woman who was raised by an alcoholic father. There should never be alcohol in her house or on my breath. May not have a theological problem. I'm separating the whole issue from Second Baptist here. If you have a theological, but I would just say being an act of kindness that smelling that on my breath is going to remind her of the horror of her childhood. Maybe one night I have just a little bit too much. My speech gets a little bit slurred. I get a little bit clumsy. And then she can't help it for her brain to go, okay, I know where this goes. Here's what's going to happen. And the whole horror story replays itself. I don't want my wife to live in fear. And so that's a spider. It's not a theological issue. It's not a sin issue. It's just that spider needs to die because that's what makes my wife feel safe. Or let's say we are in our second marriage. Certainly not. This is our first marriage and it'll be our last marriage. But let's just say in her first marriage, it was destroyed because her husband played nothing but video games all the time. I think a great spider for me to kill is just not to play video games. Because I could imagine when every time I picked up that controller, you go, here it goes. Had a lot of romance in the first marriage, and then eventually the game controller won, and it's going to happen again. Or I could imagine, yeah, honey, I'll be there in just 15 minutes and get going and then forget, and now it's an hour later. And say, you know what? I don't want to have to go through that again. I think this is, even though I'm not saying it's a sin to play a video game, in this case, this is a spider that I need to kill because I want to get close to her and this is going to keep her away from me. And it's not just things like this. It's learning to go through areas of life where you let things that would normally pull you apart draw you closer together. And you have to keep doing this throughout your marriage. Remember, I do and I will. It happened for Lisa and I now that we travel a lot together. We rarely traveled together when the kids were young and still at home. Now she's with me about 85% of the time. If it's New York or California, like we're going to next weekend, she's there with me. If it's Peoria in February, maybe not so much. So she's with me, and it's always amazed me because we'll stay at these hotels, and Lisa's the extrovert, and she's talking about the new people she's met and everything, and she just doesn't pay attention to our surroundings because she knows I do. And so I'm amazed because I'll let her go out of the elevator first, and if our room is to the right, Lisa goes left, right? If we're in the parking garage and the car is north, she goes south. You'd think half the time she would just accidentally guess right. But it's almost freaky. It's like repellent magnets. So she just, and I was amazed because one time we had been at this hotel like three nights in a row and I let her go out and she went right. And I was just like, seriously? Yeah, that didn't make her feel too close to me. It was shocking, right? And so I thought, well, that didn't work out so well. So the next time it happened, all I did is I just stayed where I was. And she kept walking and talking for about 20 yards until she realized I wasn't there. And she looked back. That also didn't please her, make her feel close to me that night. It wasn't a warm time. And so I'm like a husband trying to blame it all on her and saying, well, honey, there's nothing I can do. Because if I say something, it makes you feel stupid. If I don't say something, it makes you look angry. Obviously, there's nothing I can do. I'm not the problem here. And Lisa goes, honey, it's so easy. It's so easy. When this happens, just say, this way, hon, with exactly that tone, this way, hon, and we'll both be so happy. All right? And so I got to try it out on the next trip, right? The very next one, we go out. I go, this way, hon. She turns, she gives me this gorgeous smile, and we laugh about it all the time. And it is a rare month that it doesn't happen a couple times in her life today. But something that was pulling us apart is now drawing us together. So that's what you have to do as a couple. Use that killing spiders analogy where you just say, hon, how do I correct you? And you always say it sounds disrespectful. So tell me how I can say something that won't make you feel disrespected. I want to kill this spider. This keeps happening. It's pushing us apart. How do we make it a fun memory that pulls us back together? It goes back to the root that we marry real people with real issues and a real history. My daughter had three accidents on a freeway before she turned 23. And none of them were her fault, all right? So she didn't like driving on the freeway a whole lot. Because when it wasn't your fault any of those times and you got hit three times, it's not like you can be more careful. So when she's driving with me, she has to be in the front seat because the back seat makes her car sick. I drive like Grandpa Gary, right? And that's hard to do in Houston. I let people go. They cut me off. I'm not aggressive. I've had a lot of room. Just because I want her to feel safe when she's driving with. It's not her fault what happened to her. Every one of our spouses has a history before we married them. All right? How do we make them feel safe? How do we make them feel secure? How do we make them feel want to be close to us? We have to kill the spiders. And then finally, the fourth point is this. It's an attitude of this. I was born for this. Proverbs 17:17 says, a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. What I see happening in marriages is we get married for the good times. We get married for the sexual intimacy. We get married for the fun and the laughter. And then marriage brings us unemployment, sometimes mental illness and despair and rebellious kids or no kids or whatever it is. And we want to say, I didn't sign up for this. But if we have the Proverbs 17:17 attitudes, no, this is exactly why we got married. For when adversity reared its head, we're going to be there for each other. We got to have the attitude of a fireman. When the bell goes off, he says, I wasn't finished with my sandwich, or we're involved in a card game. No, that's why they have a job, to put out the fires. In one sense, that has to be our attitude. That's why I get married, to be there for my spouse. I think of a friend of mine, a tremendous communicator named Grant Fishbook. That literally is his name. I couldn't have made that up. Was born in Canada, was in a church, just one of those terrible church fights. It blew up and everybody was being blamed and gossiped and all of that. And he was a very young man. He really couldn't find another job after he was fired from the church. And well, he really wasn't fired. I mean, the church just kind of blew up. And so he finally got this job. It was kind of humiliating for him. He's climbing under houses. He's earning $8 an hour, coming home smelling like sewage and dirty. And his wife could be very frustrated. She said, how am I going to support these kids? They were young. She'd been at home on $8 an hour. When are you going to step up? How could you let this happen? She had the opposite attitude. She was his great champion. Grant, I know God has called you. I know God has gifted you. God is going to use you. There's going to be great things that will happen. And he realized one night just how much she was defending him. He came home early. and his wife was on the phone, and it was an animated call. Now, Lauren is not an aggressive person. She's kind of got a soft voice, but her voice was hard that time. She didn't know that Grant had come in and hear her saying, "No, you can't talk to my husband, and if you find a way to get through him, just know, then you're going to have to deal with me, because he's my husband, and I'm tired of this." And Grant could tell that wasn't the first time she had fielded a call like that. Well, Grant's gifts showed themselves. He got another chance at another church, and it grew like crazy. In fact, it became the largest church in a city that size in the entire country. It was exploding in a good way. People were coming to the Lord. People were having their faith deepened in the Lord. It was phenomenal. And one of the elders told me, "We're so sad because we know we can't keep him very long. Because we know he's going to be, churches can pay him 5 times what we can pay him. He can't really keep growing the church in a community this size. We've sort of outgrown the community." Grant is still there to this day, over 15 years after I had the conversation with the elder, and I think I know why. I called Grant and asked him, I said, "Grant, this will just be between you and me. I just kind of want to know. The reason I think you're still at Christ the King is because of Lauren's eye condition. Lauren has gradually been growing blind. Now she is legally blind, completely legally blind. They're in a small community where she knows all of her care workers. She knows what her house looked like before she went completely blind. She knows how to get everywhere. Everybody knows her." I said, "My guess is that you know this is just really what's best for Lauren." Grant was silent and said, "Yeah, I can't. I can't deny that." And then he gave me permission to tell everybody, which I do all the time. But what I love about this story is here was when Grant needed Lauren the most, instead of saying, "How could you let us get in this situation?" He said, "Grant, I'm your wife for this situation. I'm going to get you through this." And that launched him into an incredible success. And Grant could say, "I could be nationally known. I could be so much wealthier. Everybody could know my name. Why do I have to have a wife who's losing her sight?" Instead, Grant says, "You know what? I was born for this. I was born to be Lauren's husband. As she lost her sight, that's my first job." So let me ask you this, just in your marriage, what is your goal? What do you want out of your marriage? If it's intimacy, are you willing to pay the price? One of the things that's tough for me in Houston is walking through the mall around Christmas time, because they fill up the center of the mall with those kiosks. You know how they all learn to ask you questions? Can I ask you a question? Then it's a 20-minute presentation. Well, the problem is when your name's on a big screen, churches around the city, I'm afraid I don't want to be rude. I might know them, or I might have preached them or something. So I let this woman corner me. She says, "Here, give me your hand." And she did something to a couple of my fingernails with this sponge thing. And she goes, "What do you think?" I said, "I think you made them look like a girl's." She goes, "You want ridges on your fingernails?" I go, "I don't know. I don't want them to look like my wife's." I mean, I wasn't willing to pay $129 to make my fingernails look like Lisa's. I mean, I just wasn't worth paying the price. But here's the thing. Somebody might say, "Gary, why would I be honest when I don't know how my spouse will receive it? Why would I want to bless my spouse when I feel like my own needs aren't being met? Why should I kill that spider? I like that hobby. I like doing this. Why should I give that up? Why should I want to go through this adversity when I feel like we haven't had that many good times?" And here's what I'm going to say. Because if you could know what it is like to have a connected, intimate marriage, you would pay those prices. It's bargain. It's a bargain price. Because I don't know that there's anything on this earth other than a relationship with Jesus Christ that can match that intimate marriage where all four of these things are firing on all four cylinders. Yeah, it's a price. It's hard to die. It's hard to kill the spiders. It's hard to accept that adversity. It's hard to be honest. But what it provides is so much better than independent hobbies and hiding from each other and resenting each other and being selfish. If you've tried the other way, being selfish and blaming each other and lying, you know it's no fun. And I'm telling you, there's a whole different marriage, not having to marry another person, but acting as a different person. So here's what I want to ask you. And if we could bring up that slide. If you're disappointed in a disconnected marriage, if we go to that next slide, please, to your current spouse, that doesn't mean you'd be disappointed in a connected and intimate marriage to your current spouse, all right? I get if you're disappointed in your marriage, if you're disconnected. You should be. It's no fun to be in a disconnected marriage. But here's what I'm saying. Instead of changing spouses, why not first try changing disconnected to connected and see how it goes? We're launching date night. Why not just give that a chance and say, you know what? Maybe the problem isn't each other. Maybe the problem is the disconnection we have from each other. And if we deal with that, then maybe our marriage can be saved or renewed or taken from good to great.